Light. Good morning. I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Subcommittee on Education of the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Monday, March 27th. Colleagues, as you can see today, as Senator Roblin mentioned, we just have one small bill before us today. So we should only be here for about 3 or 4 weeks. I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 5524, which is the Higher Education Coordinating Committee budget bill. And I'm going to welcome to the podium for the first of many days, Executive Director Ben Cannon, who will be joined by Lisa Pearson from DAS.
Madam Chair, real briefly, this is day one of many days for HEC. There are materials on OLIS from our office. I won't go through them, but there are four or five different documents, all that I guess are combined, aren't they? And going over the issues and a brief summary of what the agency does. I'll leave that to Mr. Cannon, though, because he probably can explain it much better than I do. There'll be 3 days of public hearing, really 3.5 days of public hearing. I mean, public testimony, excuse me. The first one will be early next week, dealing with student aid or student financial assistance and some of the other initial issues that Ben will go through in the next couple days. A later day on community colleges, another day on public universities. And then toward the end, there'll be a day on OHSU, which also falls under the HEC budget. And they'll be here, and we'll have public testimony the same day that they are down from Portland.
Great. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Wilson. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We appreciate that you saved the best for last in your first review of the agency budgets in education. So we'll pull up the slides here. You should have these on OLIS, we really look forward to sharing with you what's been months in the making on the part of my staff, some of whom are here today, and I'll introduce in just a moment. The slide decks contain a lot of information. We look forward to having a conversation over the next couple of weeks with you about that information. Our staff will follow up any questions that I or whomever is presenting are unable to answer as they arise during these presentations. So we'll be taking close notes and following up promptly on your questions, but we hope that this is enriching, it's thought-provoking, and most importantly helps guide you in your or support you in your consideration of the HEC budget request. You'll see throughout the slides various photos that we've used to try to depict Oregon higher education in its many forms. And just right here at the outset, I won't be commenting on the photos generally, but right here on the opening slide, I just want to acknowledge our campus partners who have, over the years, supplied wonderful photos of some of the activities and students at their institutions. All the photos that you'll see over the next few weeks in our slides are actual reflections of Oregon colleges and universities and actual students at those colleges and universities used with their permission, and we appreciate their contributions to helping make this presentation somewhat more lively and colorful than it would be if it were just up to our data and charts and bullet points. We're going to start today by introducing the commission and the agency, talking about its mission, its history and structure, and we'll go on to talk a little bit about the students and institutions that we serve. But let me use this moment to introduce some of the folks who work closely with me, who have helped put this presentation together, and most of whom you'll hear from at various points over the next couple of weeks. So in the audience behind me are members of our HEC leadership team, and I'll start in no particular order with Patrick Crane, who's the director of our Office of Community College and Workforce Development, Juan Baez-Arevalo, who's our director of our Office of Private Postsecondary, as well as our interim director of OSAC, the Office of Student Access and Completion in Eugene, that falls under the HEC. Veronica Dujon, who's our director of academic affairs, focusing on our public universities, and Andrew Rogers, who co-leads that university office, but focuses on budget and finance. Amy Cox, our director of research and data. Dave Zerbe, who's our director of operations. I don't see Karen Hummelbaugh, but you'll hear from her when we're talking about workforce investments. Our deputy executive director, Bob Brew, works very closely with me in helping lead the organization. And then a few folks who have been really instrumental in helping think holistically about the HEC and about this presentation. Kyle Thomas, our director of legislative and policy affairs. Cheryl Myers, our director of diversity and equity. And Endi Hartigan, our communications director, who's principally responsible for these slides and their layout. So speaking of slides, this is where we are and where we're headed over the 15 days that have been allotted. And you'll note the public testimony days on day 6, day 9, and 13 that Doug mentioned at the outset. We have days reserved for presentations from some of the institutions or their representatives that we support. So days 7 and 8 will include an introduction to community colleges from me and from Patrick Crane on our staff, but we'll turn it over to community college representatives themselves for presentations. Likewise, in days 10 and 11, we'll introduce our work relative to the state's public universities, but turn it over to the public universities and their representatives for presentation. And likewise, on day 14, we'll turn it over to OHSU for their budget and testimony on their budget. We have attempted some level of coordination with the institutions, but really you're hearing separately from us and from the institutions. This slide with the schedule, you'll see repeated at other points. We're going to try to help sort of orient you to where we are in the presentation, so don't be surprised to see this one pop up again. Day 1 and 2, so we're here at the outset today and tomorrow with, again, introducing our higher ed structure and students, describing a little about our progress towards state goals and talking about the funding history in Oregon higher education. I do want to finally note day 15 is where we'll take a deep dive on the HEC agency's operational budget. So the folks behind me, our positions and our staffs, our organizational charts, we will go over that in some detail in day 15, the final day set aside for our presentation. So our vision statement, we are governed by a 14-member commission, and back in 2013, it adopted this vision statement for Oregon higher education. It hasn't changed. We'll foster and sustain the best, most rewarding pathways to opportunity and success for all Oregonians through an accessible, affordable, and coordinated network for educational achievement beyond a high school diploma. Key responsibilities. So this is an attempt to summarize or distill what in the heck the HEC does for Oregon higher education. And we've kind of organized it here in four key points. And the first is really around providing that single point of strategic vision for Oregon higher education planning, funding, and policy. So we are at our core a planning, funding, and policy setting organization. We do not run Oregon higher education in the sense of governance. We don't oversee directly the public institutions or certainly private ones that we help to support and coordinate. We don't oversee their boards. We don't oversee their presidents. There are certain authorities that we share with those institutions, but for the most part, our role is coordinating, not governing. And we'll talk much more about that as we get down into the weeds and look at the particular sectors. But this top item here really establishes the role that we play in planning, funding, and policy. We do, moving on to the sort of second category here, we do authorize, we have the authority to determine whether or not post-secondary programs and degrees are offered in Portland's or in Oregon higher education. So we, for example, approve mission statements of our public universities. We approve or disapprove new degree programs at our public institutions and many of our regulated private institutions as well, which come to our commission and its staff for licensure authorization to operate in Oregon. The third sort of key bar here describes our role in administering programs, and there are significant state programs, including the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise, Aspire, implementation of the Federal Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act that we administer through our staff and offices. And finally, the fourth kind of bar here describes our work in evaluation and reporting, in data keeping, in monitoring. And that bar is the basis for much of the data and information that you'll see presented to you over the next several weeks, and that helps inform our strategic and policy work. A little bit about our history and structure. So the offices here, the offices of our HEC agency, are described in the bottom. I mentioned a couple of slides ago, we're overseen by a 14-member commission. 9 of those members are voting members, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Our chair, Neil Bryant, former chair Tim Nesbitt, no longer on the commission. Our current chair, Neil Bryant, would be here today if he could to help introduce this. You may see him later on in the presentation. But we are governed, as I said, overseen by a 14-member commission. We have the 8 offices described below. This is the sort of circle with the clover leaf in the middle is an attempt to depict graphically how those offices are organized, with overlapping responsibilities and connections between community colleges, universities, private, post-secondary, our workforce investments, our work around student access and completion, and then all of those offices supported by our research and data unit, our operations unit, and the executive director office that I oversee. We will use Higher Education Coordinating Commission to describe both our commission, those governor-appointed 14 members, as well as our agency, our staff, led by me. That can be confusing, but that's how it's laid out in statute. So much like TSPC, which you've already heard, where there is a volunteer commission and also an agency, we share that sort of confusing feature of having a volunteer commission that is the same name as our employed state agency, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We are relatively new. So the HEC, as all of you know, the HEC is a relatively new creature in Oregon state government. This slide, which goes back just to 2011 and the origin of the HEC, describes in a sort of the briefest possible way some of the significant transformations that have occurred in the governance of Oregon higher education over that time period. I'm not going to go through all of this. In a nutshell, just a couple of points. There has been significant consolidation of state governance and policymaking for higher education. That's reflected in that from 5 state agency boards to 1, and I can describe that in greater detail. But today it is the case that the HEC is the single point of state government focus for higher education. Essentially, everything having to do with Oregon higher education at the state level comes through the HEC, our commission and agency. At the same time, we have created many more governing boards for Oregon public institutions. So we used to have a Oregon university system, a single governing board and single chancellor overseeing 7 public universities. Today, each of those universities, as you know, has their own boards. So at the state level, we have a single one point of focus where we used to have 5, the OEIB, the HEC, the State Board of Higher Ed, the State Board of Ed, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission all had slices of responsibility for different sectors, community colleges, financial aid, public universities, and then the OEIB and HEC in some coordinating roles. Today, that really all comes through our single commission, so a much greater level of coordination there. At the same time, putting governance closer to the institutions that are being overseen by their respective boards and administrations at the public universities, which mirrors the longstanding independence and local governments that our community colleges have operated under. From a somewhat, messy but cleaner than it used to be graphical standpoint, this is the state higher education landscape in a nutshell, with a particular focus on the public side. The left hand kind of column here over on the left hand part of the slide describes our state education partners. The items in green are the boards or commissions. The items in brown are the agencies themselves. So these are the folks who we work with. Chief Education Office, of course, ODE and the State Board of Ed with their K-12 or PK-12 focus, TSPC, Employment, the Workforce Investment Board, and the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps Advisory Committee. And then the HEC agency and commission described in the center, the offices that I mentioned are shown as flowing from that agency. And then over on the right-hand side are 24, really 25, including OHSU, public institutions of higher education, each with their own institutional boards. So, again, a really important distinction that we'll spend additional time on when we talk about our public universities and our community colleges, but the distinction between the HEC's role in coordinating, setting policy, developing state funding and budget structures and supports, a distinction between that work on the one hand and the institutional governance work that the 25 separate boards do on the right.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Ben, the three big universities and OHSU all have their separate boards. The small ones have separate boards as well, but don't they have a different a relationship with each other, the small universities? How do they differ from the structure of the big universities, or is there any difference?
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, structurally, the seven public universities operate under statutorily identical sets of boards and responsibilities. So there is no distinction. They have they're on equal terms under statute as the three large universities with an identical relationship with the HEC and each other. The universities themselves have chosen to enter into voluntary agreements with each other that differ from university to university for certain kinds of administrative shared services. But from a governance standpoint, they are all seven identical.
Thank you. That's helpful.
And Mr. Cannon, can I ask you one question about this as well? Can you talk briefly, and I'm sure we'll get into it further, but the difference between the workforce investments box and the community college and workforce development.
Yes. Representative Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. Yes. So we have, under the HEC agency, created two offices that have direct workforce related responsibilities. As you noted, one of them is the Office of Workforce Investment. It is primarily, although not exclusively, but primarily focused on implementation of the federal of Title I of the Federal Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, which is basically focused on connecting Oregon job seekers with job opportunities and helping to train or skill up existing employees, supporting dislocated workers. And Karen Hummelbaugh on our team will describe in greater depth in several days additional work of that office. Our Community College and Workforce Development Office, or CCWD, in addition to supporting community colleges, helps implement Title II of the Federal Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, which involves services that traditionally and today are made available primarily through Oregon community colleges, including ESL, GED, adult basic skills, programs and activities, again, significantly funded through the Federal Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, but we deploy those through a distinct office that is primarily community college focused.
Okay, thank you.
This slide, which describes a few of the accomplishments since we last came before this committee for budget in 2015, is not meant primarily to brag, but rather to provide some texture for what we do. So just to give a stronger, sort of clearer sense of what it is that this agency does. So we, since 2015-16, have submitted 23 reports to the Oregon legislature on topics of interest to policy leaders, many of those, most of those ones that you required us to submit as a result of legislation that was passed in 2015-16. We launched the Oregon Promise. We restructured the Oregon Opportunity Grant, both of those in conjunction with bills passed by the 2015 legislature. We implemented a new model for funding or allocating funding to the public universities, the student success and completion model. We implemented that through a rule adopted by our commission. We oversee, as I mentioned, a federal workforce CTE, GED, and adult basic skills program in conjunction with our partners. And then finally, in the bottom section, our commission has adopted additional new standards for accelerated learning programs, high school and college programs. We've overseen, really developed, and are running an outreach program around FAFSA completion that we'll be excited to describe to you in a few days. And we have worked to support students who attended schools, private regulated schools that closed, including the students at ITT Tech, who, as you know, we worked with you to support at least the nursing students through teach-out arrangements at Portland Community College. Those are just a few of the types of ways in which we work with students and institutions and have since 2015-16.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Director Cannon, are we going to have other time to discuss what you're introducing today? Like, I'd like to get into more about the rules about the funding.
Representative Wisnant, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, yes. So when we talk about the public university budget, which we are scheduled to do on starting on day 10, we'll spend a fair amount of time on the allocation formula itself, the student success and completion model, which, as you know, is a sort of outcomes-focused formula that we're in the middle of implementing.
Follow-up. Clarification. Thank you. Because the policy was done by rules, you said, and during that time, I'd like to be sure that we don't need to put that in statute.
Representative Wisnant, co-chairs would be happy to have that conversation.
Thank
at
you.
That point. I'm not going to spend any time on this next slide, but just note it for you here. It's essentially the same schedule of our presentation, but what we've added on the left hand is the HEC specific role in each of these areas. So again, I'm trying to spend some time at the outset here to help ground you in what we do, because we don't do community college education in Oregon directly. We don't oversee it for the most part directly, nor do we do public university or other higher education. But we do have very specific roles and responsibilities relative to each of these sectors. And this slide attempts in each of these areas to give you a sense of what our key responsibilities for each of these are. As you'll notice, for example, OHSU, we have practically nothing to do with. They will bring forward their own budget. We attempt to coordinate with them for the purposes of getting them in front of the legislature, for example. And certainly, there are some other discrete kind of policy areas where there's certain opportunity for coordination with OHSU, but we do not have statutory responsibilities there, and that's why that box is so modest compared to some of the others. So let's talk budget, again, starting at a pretty high level with some of our commission's budget priorities as reflected in the governor's recommended budget, which itself was a reflection of the recommendations that the commission made to the governor. So this is just taken from the GRB, emphasizes her focus on opening the doors of college opportunity and success for students and families, and the potential that post-secondary education has to foster equity, economic mobility, and successful futures for all Oregonians. The higher education budget represents 9.7% of the state's total general fund and lottery fund budget. These are drawn from 2015-17, so this is our existing budget, and we show it there in a pie chart alongside K-12 education, which is that 40.4%, and then other state budgets, non-education budgets, which are the 48.4. That 9.7%, that is the HEX budget. That is the post-secondary budget, of course, most of which is passed on by our commission to our public colleges, universities, and students via scholarship and access programs. And that's what's described here. So now if we zero in on that particular wedge of the pie, that 9.7%, or roughly $1.8 billion of the total state general fund lottery fund budget, here you see it broken up within the HEC budget by major category. We've depicted it three ways, the LAB from 2015-17, our CSL and GRB. I don't show the slide to try to emphasize differences between them there, but rather to show in a sense the way that the breakout is roughly the same. And obviously we'll be talking more about these differences as we get into details, but starting from the left, and if we take just the LAB, you see our debt service in that green category that represents about $186 million. These are this is debt service that we pay as a result of capital commitments that the state has made for our public institutions. Then moving to the red, about $150 million in state financial aid. This includes the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise. Moving on, our two largest investment funds in our community colleges and our public universities, respectively, at 565 and 667. You see other university support. These are specific items within our university budget. They're in the footnote at $165 million. The OHSU fund at about 77. A sliver of state general fund for workforce activities at about 8.2, and then the agency operations in the current budget at $24 million, and in our CSL budget at about $22 million as a result of limited duration positions and other projects that were in our 2015 budget that are not in our CSL budget for 2017-19. So that $22 million represents, you know, a little over 1% of the total state investment in post-secondary education. That's the agency budget that we'll focus on in day in the last day of our presentation, day 15. Thematically, there are three major priorities in the governor's budget for higher education. The first is affordability and investments that increase state need-based aid, as well as fully fund the Oregon Promise program. And we'll talk about these in more detail in days 3 and 4. But if you look at the governor's budget and with the limited resources that she had to work with, where the major sort of new post-secondary investments are, they really are primarily in this category where the governor's budget recommends a significant increase in the Opportunity Grant and then the fully funding the Oregon Promise, which, as you know, on a biennial basis, comes with a not insignificant price tag. Yeah. The second major priority around student success, and here it really is expressed through sustaining the funding that we are making today in our public institutions, our community colleges, and our universities in order to permit them to continue to invest in students and, in particular, the success of those students. The budget also includes significant increases in capital construction bonding for our community colleges and public universities, as well as a fund for campus safety infrastructure, all of which, again, designed to support the ability of campuses to support student success and completion. And finally, the third major budget priority, and we'll be spending a lot of time on each of these, just to sort of organize the themes, the third is sustaining investments to simplify and improve student pathways. And here, sort of again coming back to the role and responsibility of the HEC, a particular focus on creating smooth pathways between sectors and institutions. So at those transition points, helping ensure that students are supported in reaching their higher education and workforce goals. Sure.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Ben, there's been a lot of discussion about transferability of credits within our system from community colleges to universities or from one university to another or even from our accredited private universities to our public universities. Can you speak to transferability and what needs to change to so that we have a homogeneous system where students, wherever they get their credits, whether it be dual credit classes at the high school level or at a community college, can count on those credits then being useful if they move to a different institution?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, it's a big question, an important question. I appreciate you sort of planting that flag early, we will spend a significant portion of our fifth presentation day on the sort of question of transitions, on the sort of specific issue of credit and course transferability. It is an area where we have a lot of work to do, and the HEC, as a coordinating commission, believes we have significant, although not exclusive or necessarily primary responsibility, but significant responsibility to help ensure that credits earned one place can be meaningfully applied to another institution, especially given the mobility of our students and the number of transitions that they make. We're working with the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce on potential legislation that would help address a portion of this issue. It's focused on the transfer between community colleges and public universities, so from two-year to four-year schools, and the sort of credit loss issues that are associated with that transfer experience for many students. So there's much to do on this topic, and potential role for state policymakers, and certainly a role for the HEC in helping improve that experience.
Yeah, some are follow-up. Some are doing an outstanding job. I mean, I'm thinking of Lynn Benton and Oregon State, for example, probably a classic example of doing it right. But it seems to me that that ought to be the case all over our state.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Cannon, back to slide 15. And I agree completely with Senator Monroe. Is, I think, one of the big cost drivers is transferability of credits. I've worked on the Higher Education Policy Committee since it was started, and worked on education for several years in this building. I know that our Higher Education Committee, our mission was to make college more affordable and access, which is opportunity, which is your slide here. If we continue increase opportunity grants in Oregon Promise, but we don't get ahead of the game, it's because of the cost drivers. And, you know, because you're already hearing 7-8% tuition increase. So we're not getting ahead. I've read enough articles and education and things that some of the cost drivers and things that I understand that you're in a business and you're competing for students, but are we going to hear any results or analysis about does it really bring in more students if we have a, million-dollar student center or lodging or swimming pool and all these other recreational opportunities? Are we getting into the resort business or competing with resorts in construction of colleges and what we're providing colleges versus some of our friends across the ocean? I don't think their facilities are up to par with what we are. So are we going to hear more about that? Are we just going to say, yeah, affordability and opportunity are goals? But if we keep raising tuition, it doesn't matter how much more money we put in the pot. It's not going to help students go to college and more students. So, I think I supported the reorganization. I think your organization does a great job. But we have to at some point say, University of Oregon system, you will transfer credits within the system. You know, you will do what's necessary to provide safe and secure housing for our students. But we do this every year. We come in and talk about affordability and opportunity, and then we increase tuition. You know, I was here the first year. It was a weight off. Do you get more opportunity grant or, because it's a tough job you have. I understand that the colleges have. But are we really going to hear anything or talk about what we're trying to do to control the cost drivers and administration, too? And I understand administration is a lot of our fault. We tell you to do all these things, so you have to go out and hire more administrators. But we got to get a handle on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Whitson, co-chairs, so when we describe the community college and public university budgets, we will talk about cost drivers. And certainly you will have the opportunity to put that question as well to the colleges and universities themselves. I would say this, because we've spent a lot of time, I've asked my staff and I personally have spent a lot of time looking at the sort of total costs within higher education. We are tired, as I know you and students are tired, of sort of year over year tuition increases that feel sort of unsustainable and unpayable. My sort of general takeaway at a big picture around costs across post-secondary generally is that the total costs associated with higher education are increasing at a rate that's pretty comparable to public sector agencies in Oregon generally. They're driven by labor costs. Those labor costs are subject to the same sorts of pressures that our agency budgets and other sort of state agency budgets are subject to. And I don't see evidence for cost growth within the higher education sector writ large that's inconsistent with the cost increases that we see in other units, other sort of public agencies within Oregon. That's not to say that the sort of questions and concerns and issues that you raise are not valid, and we'll get into greater detail around some of them when we look at the public universities and community colleges more specifically. But I guess at the outset, I do want to try to ensure that the commission doesn't, or that the committee doesn't have perspective, because I think it would be inaccurate, that cost increases in higher education significantly outrun cost increases in other public sector agencies.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I probably know the answer, but I have to ask this. So this whole simplifying student pathways has been something I've heard about even when I was in school, which has been many years ago. I'm just trying to understand, so what's so difficult about getting to something I think we all agree makes great sense?
Representative Lively, co-chairs, members of the committee, we could spend a lot of time on this topic, and I love this topic, but I want to be, I'll try to be simple. Higher education, as even these slides have suggested, has is governed in a complex and shared way. Decisions are made at a lot of points within the system. There is not a single board or body that determines what the content and standards associated with a particular writing course are, for example, or even with a bachelor's degree, right? That's not the responsibility or the authority of my organization to say what lower division general education outcomes ought to be, or what course standards ought to be. And this is an important contrast for you to keep in mind, given that you're coming off of having reviewed the Department of Education's budget and their board's significant role and responsibility and authority to set standards for K-12 education. That does not exist in higher education. So what we have is around sort of academic outcomes and requirements is a sort of set of largely locally governed, locally determined, institutionally determined, faculty determined requirements that are kind of loosely confederated and are accreditation agencies. In Oregon, the Northwest Commission on Accreditation does sort of play a hand in helping try to ensure that a degree is a degree is a degree, and that there is a certain amount of equivalency. But I guess my sort of simplistic answer to your question would be, we don't have more equivalency. This remains a challenge because of the way in which the decentralized nature of higher education governance and oversight.
Thank you.
Moving on. So we wanted here on the first day to spend a few minutes talking about why post-secondary education matters, and what are those returns on investment for the individual, for the taxpayer, for the community. And this seems particularly relevant and important in a moment, in an era, when costs to the student are increasing. And the question for students and families of, is this worth it, is increasingly being asked. So recognizing that I may be preaching to the choir here, we did want to spend a few minutes sort of sharing some of the data that illustrates that higher education, post-secondary education, remains a very important and valuable investment. I want to start with some new data. This is the result of a national study undertaken by some researchers at Stanford, at the Department of Treasury, using IRS tax data and some other researchers. And this is a longitudinal view of basically what they've looked at: millions of students who were born in the early 1980s. Okay, so get that in your mind, millions of students born in the early 80s who were college age around the turn of the millennium, and who therefore are now in the sort of 2014-15 time period, have recently entered the point in their careers around age 35 where their earnings trajectory is stable. So essentially we're going to look now at these children who were born around 1980, their college participation rates around the turn of the millennium, and their kind of pretty predictive workforce earnings outcomes. And we're going to attempt to understand how higher education contributes to equality of opportunity. So what I've done here on this graph, what the researchers have done, is plotted their parents' income rank on the horizontal axis, and the child's income rank, that child cohort who I just described to you, on the vertical axis. So if we were living in a society with perfect equality of opportunity, a parent's income rank, 0, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100, so from lowest income to highest income, would not predict the child's outcome at age 35, right? So that's that flat bar at 50. There would be no relationship between a parent's income and a child's income at age 35. That would be in a perfect society where equality of opportunity was perfectly complete. Let me put that. I didn't mean to say perfect society, but one where equality of opportunity would be complete. We know we don't live in that society, and what I will show you now are the actual results for this cohort of students based on their parents' income rank. Again, this was done with access to millions of IRS tax filings. So the outcomes for students, depending on whether or not they attended college and what type of college they attended. So these are for students who never attended college. And as you can see, their outcome, their income rank at age 35, that's the vertical axis here, it depends on their parents' income rank, and it's pretty low. You never get even up to 50%, even for those students whose parents were relatively high income. I think you can speculate about that tail at the sort of 90th percentile and above. Students whose parents are quite affluent, who didn't attend college, they are likely living to some extent off of their parents, even at age 35, or benefiting from family wealth in that respect. So those are students who never attended college. Students who attended a two-year school, again, they were born in the early 80s, they were college age around the turn of the millennium, we're now looking at their outcomes at age 35. And you see here a couple of things. One is that their earnings are significantly higher, so their likelihood of being at that 50th percentile or above is significantly higher. The line has flattened, and this isn't highly perceptible here, but there's less, the parents' rank, income rank has less impact on the students' outcome. The line has flattened somewhat, and clearly their results are better than if they had not attended college. For most four-year schools, higher yet, and then for our elite colleges and universities, this is again was a national study. You see the outcomes here that for students whose parents were very low income, looking at these black, red, and green bars, even for our lowest income students, the fact that they attended a two-year school or a four-year school meant that their likelihood of being in that 50th percentile or better for income is significantly greater. So this one of many ways, and I'll show you some others, to depict the impact of higher education on economic mobility.
Senator Roblin?
So this is has attended a two-year school, not graduated. In each of those cases, is that the case?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, that was one of my first questions as well. And yes, these are students who attended. Now, there's a definition of attendance that ensures they attended for at least a certain period of time, but they didn't necessarily graduate. And one would expect that if this limited those black, red, and green bars just to students who completed, the relationship would be even stronger with income. But no, this includes students who attended and didn't complete.
And follow up.
Follow up.
So do we know, was there any explanation of the dip on every one of those in the most, the wealthiest parent group, except for the elite schools?
Senator Roblin, co-chairs, yes, I think the researchers in their paper do speculate that that's the result of students who basically have less earning needs because their parents are so affluent. And they, frankly, may be more likely, as a result of, for example, not having college debt, to go into lower income careers, right? They require, you know, less income as a result of their parents' affluence, and as a result may choose less income-producing careers. Co-chairs, members of the committee, before I leave this slide, this is just a very small snapshot of what is really an extraordinary contribution to research and data around higher education. And we've linked to the study here. The researchers have produced mobility reports for all of every U.S. college and university in the country, so you can look and see what these results mean, including not just how do the students do, but how many come from each segment of the parent rank. America's challenge is not even as much with higher education being a lever to move students up. It's getting students from those lower income bands there in the first place. So it's great that a student whose parent is very low income but attends a four-year school does pretty well. The problem is not nearly enough students with parents of low income get to that school in the first place. And the reporting that that group of researchers have done really illustrate that writ large, and then also illustrate the schools, including some Oregon schools, where that that challenge is being directly and successfully addressed. Here's another way of looking at return on investment, a more sort of conventional way, or return on the sort of educational investment, and we just simply depicting annual earnings and unemployment rate by level of educational attainment. So as you would expect, higher levels of educational attainment are associated with higher median annual earnings and lower levels of unemployment. These stats came from 2015. The unemployment figures, as you know, have declined since then, although we've not updated them by educational level since then. I expect the relationship still holds. Tax returns, or sort of a virtual cycle of prosperity for students, and then the investments that makes possible by the state. So this now looks at the U.S. tax payments. So we don't have this with Oregon data, but the U.S. taxpayers payments of full-time year-round workers age 25 and older by educational level. So you see at the top bar here, Americans with professional degrees on average are responsible for almost $29,000 in U.S. tax payments. You can see that down the list. Obviously, those higher income earners are also contributing more in the way of taxes, and we expect that this relationship holds also with Oregon income tax payments as well. And then this slide just attempts to sort of denote that the benefits of higher education are not strictly financial, either for the individual or for the state. But higher levels of post-secondary education also correlate with being less likely to participate in public assistance programs such as Medicaid, school lunch, SNAP, and housing assistance, people being less likely to live in households at the poverty level, higher voting rates, higher volunteer rates, people being more likely to have employer-provided health insurance coverage, higher rates of physical exercise, lower smoking rates, lower obesity rates for individuals and their children, and the list goes on. So the benefits of higher education are to the individual in the form of earnings, the individual and their family, to the community in the form of tax payments, and then to the individual, the community, the family, in non-financial ways, including some of those described on this by this study. Coming back to the job picture, I think this slide is fascinating. So this is starts at 2008 on the left-hand side and goes through 2016 on the right-hand side. This is from the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce. You have the recession sort of in the light gray until 2010. And this describes job loss or gain nationally based on level of education. And so the top line, the blue line, is Americans with bachelor's degrees or higher, who, as you see, there was very little in the way of job growth during the recession, but there actually wasn't much in the way of job loss either. And then you see the steep takeoff during the recovery. The orange line are Americans with associate's degrees or some college, and you do see a significant dip for that group, job loss of nearly 2 million in the recession, but then recovery back to their pre-recession levels, and in the last couple of years, job growth to the tune of 1.3 million. For Americans with a high school diploma or less, steep job loss during the recession between 2008 and 2010 without recovery. And as the note on the slide indicates, over 99% of job growth in the recovery has gone to workers with more than a high school education. This slide, I think, should be quite compelling to Oregonians and other job seekers who are concerned about getting getting back to work and the relationship between education and that that opportunity.
Senator Roblin.
So this is strictly on the numbers. Do we know the percentage of people in each of those three groups so that we could actually show that, I mean, most people exist probably in the bottom group because we haven't gotten to 40-40-20. And so we aren't over 50%. So the vast majority of people who live in the country are in that light blue or whatever, aqua color. It would really just, from my perspective, be nice to know the number of people in each of those groups, because I think it shows why the unemployment for the top one is much lower than the people in the bottom one. But with that graph, I would have thought the bottom group would have even gone higher with unemployment, actually. So thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. I mean, I appreciate graphs like this, but I don't know that they tell the whole story. A lot of the articles I've been reading about sort of the recovery of jobs is that we've got a lot of folks who have associates and bachelor's degrees, particularly in a state like Oregon, where our service sector has grown. Those degrees are in service sector jobs, so they're minimum wage or above with a degree, which explains the piece about, you know, folks with high school degrees not going back. It's still have that middle job gap that is happening, and folks with associates and even some bachelors, depending on what they got, aren't going into those middle wage jobs because they don't have the right skill, which is certainly leaving, I think, your high school diploma or GED students out of what would otherwise be sort of that service sector work. And this also, if you can find the data, would be interested to see, you know, it's great we've seen that growth in jobs, but are those jobs, you know, sort of lower end service sector jobs, or are they really higher wage jobs that weren't getting the level of education and taking on the level of debt that we're asking students to do? And I think there's some missing data from that slide, if you have a way to find it.
Representative Parrish, co-chairs, I think it's a good and important point. The next couple of slides give a sort of partial answer to it, although don't get all of the way there, but we'll start to look at some particular job categories in Oregon and their related educational needs. So co-chairs, with your permission, I will turn directly to slide 24. And with this slide, we've used Bureau of Labor Statistics projections of occupations with the most job growth. So this is a selective look at occupations that are projected to have the most job growth over the next 10 years. We've plotted them on a chart where the higher on the chart you are, the higher the earnings associated with that job. The lower on the chart you are, the lower earnings. The size of the bubble represents the amount of projected openings in that field. So small bubbles are fewer openings. Big bubbles are more openings. And the color, yellow or light blue or green, represents the minimum educational requirements associated with that job. So here we're looking forward now, looking over the next 10 years using these projections about where the jobs will be available and then their minimum educational requirements for them. And so you can see a couple of things. One, according to those minimal requirements, there are a lot of job openings or are projected to be a lot of job openings that don't require a beyond high school level education at the minimum level. That's the yellow clustered along the bottom. Those are also the jobs that, not surprisingly, pay the least. That's why they're clustered along the bottom. There are also a lot of projected job openings that require bachelor's, associates, or certificates, and they do tend to be higher wage jobs. Before I pause, this slide depicts minimal educational requirements. So what's the minimal to get in the threshold? It appears to be the case in Oregon and throughout the country that to be competitive for at least some of these yellow occupations today, one has to have, or at least is advantaged to have, an associate's degree, certificate, or bachelor's degree. And that starts to get at the point the Representative Parrish made, where there may be some mismatching between people who have earned degrees or certificates but are in lower wage jobs where they're not strictly required. So this, and you know, there's obviously a lot of data behind the slide, including, you know, the ability to go in and look at what each of these job categories are. I'll show some of those on the next slide. Let me pause and just see if there are any questions about this somewhat sort of complex depiction.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So I see you've got some underlying source data and have not had a chance to go look at that, but you know, curious if that source data includes the projections that we're seeing out of, like, Congressional Budget Office and, you know, National Bureau of Labor around job automation and just the sheer amount of automation that's happening, which will certainly put compression into the system around what your degree is worth and your ability to attain a job. Are we beginning to factor that and start to think about where those jobs? I was very surprised to read that some of that automation isn't just like, you know, you go and punch a McDonald's and order your own Happy Meal in the service sector, but that we're also looking at jobs like finance. You know, we're sending people in with business degrees, and those jobs are being automated as well. So how much does this account for where job economists are thinking automation is going?
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, we'll have to follow up with you about the underlying assumptions in this study, which isn't ours but comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and we'd be happy to do that. moving on to slide 25. So this is a sort of a closer look at family wage jobs requiring a post-secondary education. So now using Oregon Employment Department data and their projections around job growth over the next 10 years, of the 100 jobs with the largest growth, projected growth in Oregon, 40 have above average earnings, and 30 of those 40 require post-secondary education. So these are the fields that are projected to grow and have higher than average earnings. Salary ranges in the sort of $53,000 to $143,000 level. And, you know, I'm not going to read these. You can see these. But this is where job growth is concentrated for people who have degrees.
May I just ask, are there any significance to the different colored lines?
There are not.
Okay. I didn't think there was, but I just wanted to confirm.
It looks beautiful.
It does look beautiful.
So turning away now from the question of return on investment towards sort of the question of how we're doing on Oregon higher education, how well are we doing in meeting the state goals? I'll start with the most familiar goal to you, the 40-40-20 goal, which establishes that by the year 2025, 40% of adult Oregonians will hold a bachelor's or advanced degree, 40% will have an associate's degree or meaningful post-secondary certificate, and all adult Oregonians will hold a high school diploma. This was established in law in 2011. I do want to note, this is not the only higher education goal in state law, nor is it the only higher education goal that drives the commission's work. It is the only quantitative one, and it's the one that I'll use to describe some quantitative measurement towards that goal. Our commission's strategic plan is organized around six key priorities: goal setting and the work that we have to do in monitoring progress towards goals, funding strategies, pathways, which we've talked about already, student support, college affordability, and economic and community impact. It's anchored in equity lens, which I'll speak to in a few slides. But these six goals are sort of the primary focus of our commission's strategic plan. How is the state doing? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Director Cannon, if we're doing the funding by graduation, shouldn't one of the key priorities be graduation?
Representative Wisnett, co-chairs, yes. And the 40-40-20 goal itself is a completion-related goal.
Thank you.
Completion of bachelor's and or advanced degrees, associate's degrees, or meaningful post-secondary certificates.
You.
So how are we doing? And this will be a familiar depiction to some of you who have seen it in, I think to all of you. We used it at our opening presentation with the Chief Education Office. But to review, the goal itself is described in the right-hand bar. That's the 40-40-20. And our progress towards that goal as of 2015 is described in the left-hand bar. So on that bachelor's or advanced degree, about 33% of adult Oregonians report having obtained a bachelor's or advanced degree. Another 17%, we estimate, have earned an associate's degree or undergraduate certificate. About additional 18% have attended college but not earned a degree. And the remaining 32% have earned a high school diploma or have not completed high school, so that they have not touched college, but in fact, the majority of them have completed high school or its equivalent.
Senator Monroe.
Yes, Ben, there's legislation introduced that would do away with the 40-40-20 goal. Do you wish to comment on that?
Senator Monroe, co-chair, members of the committee, we presented testimony to the House Education Committee last week in the public hearing on that bill. We noted the role that 40-40-20 has played in guiding our commission in the development of its budget recommendations, in its funding strategies, including the relationship to completion, and in the development of a strategic plan, which is designed to get at 40-40-20. We noted the fact that there are other goals in Oregon statute for higher education, and we certainly welcome the opportunity to think more holistically about how those sort of comprehensive set of higher education goals could be organized in statute, consistent with generally the policy of executive branch agencies and the governor's office. We don't have a position on the legislation, but we did underscore the importance of 40-40-20 in helping to sort of shape our commission's work and priorities.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
So we started this in 2011, I think, was when it was implemented. So do we have the same bars for 2011, 2013, and 15? So we can actually see if there's any growth? Because it would really be nice to know, here we are, here's where we want to go. It would be nice to see if we've made any progress along the way. And number two, one of the concerns that I think some people have is if you look back at your slide 24, which showed the future of jobs in Oregon, they don't need any of those people. I mean, if you look at your deal, where the growth is in the people that don't have a high school education. All the big yellow bubbles going out forward, there aren't any of the other bubbles, it doesn't look like. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma from my perspective with regard to what kind of workforce you're projecting we need and what kind of education you're projecting. So, I mean, it could be that it'll just lower the college graduates will have to take the low jobs, but it's interesting data that I'm looking at. It's confusing a bit.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, let me come back to that question a moment in connection with 40-40-20. I was a participant, like many of you, in some of the conversations around 40-40-20 then and now. And I'll say a couple of things. One is, it is clear when you look at these occupational growth projections that we are not projecting an economy that strictly requires the 40-40-20 level of degree production at the minimum level. There is no question. You can't even sort of massage the numbers to get to a projection around a 40-40-20 economy. However, I believe the architects of 40-40-20, and I do not include myself in that category, but those who, beginning in the sort of mid to late 2000s, began thinking about a goal for Oregon adult educational attainment, the question for them was not what occupations and jobs are we projecting and what are the educational qualifications associated with them. The question was primarily, what kind of economy do we want to have in Oregon? And the bet was placed that creating, that training and educating more Oregonians to higher levels of education would help to build and drive a knowledge-based economy. And there is evidence from other states and countries that have placed significant bets on higher education of that effect. It is arguably too early to say whether that bet has paid off or will pay off in Oregon. And I acknowledge that these job occupation statistics certainly, you know, do give pause, right? When we look at 40-40-20 and we look at the jobs themselves. We are, as a commission, we've brought forward partly for this reason, we've introduced legislation that would pull 40-40-20 apart and treat the adult population separately from our rising young Oregonians population. And it would leave 40-40-20 attached to today's fourth graders. My daughter's in the class, high school class of 2025. I hope high school class, projected to be in the high school class of 2025. She's a fourth grader. So we would leave 40-40-20 because we don't know what the economy of 2025 will be. And the architects of 40-40-20, I think, envisioned that better to train for that economy of the future, educate for that economy of the future than for today's job occupations. But for working age Oregonians today, our commission's proposal in legislation is to say, let's have a set of higher educational goals that more accurately reflects the actual available jobs, right? So, and maybe that's not 40-40-20. In fact, it's not 40-40-20 today. So when we're making workforce investments and educational investments for dislocated workers or other adult Oregonians, we're doing so with a clearer view of what the job opportunities are for them today. And actually, that's described in a couple of slides.
I have two questions on the House side. Representative Parrish?
Thanks. Director Cannon, we socially promote 97% of kids in this state, so your kid's going to be probably just fine up to 2025. But so I wouldn't worry about that. I do have a question, though, however, about the brown line, because I feel like when we did the 40-40-20, that I think we forgot to say that the brown line's okay, right? So the brown on some college, no degree. What's happening, I think, sort of a phenomenon right now as we've moved either workers back in and they're getting job retraining at our community colleges and then moving on without a degree, is, or even in some of our high school programs where they get a few college credits but then don't go on to school, but they've landed in a job. They've landed in a family wage job. I can think of a student I know who graduated out of the Sabin Schellenberg Center in Clackamas and immediately got a job at Gunderson Marine paying $45,000 with full benefits as an 18-year-old kid, has now moved on to even another job and is making more money than that and only still got the few college credits or whatever that they got. And I think somewhere when we crafted this 40-40-20, we forgot to say that that's an okay. It's a little bit more than a high school, and it's not a full college degree, but we didn't account for that in the aspirational goals. And to me, part of an education is get the education you need to move on, and it might not, might not be the actual certificate, but if it's got you where you need to be, then is that enough? And I think we missed that part. And we know that there right now we need 1 million coders in this country in the next 3 years, and that does not require a college degree. So how do we sort of rethink that lens? I won't support the legislation that takes us away from 40-40-20 that's in the House Ed Committee, but I do want us to have that conversation about that brown line, and is there room for that in our aspirational goals, and how do we account for that?
I think there's a slide coming up very briefly about that, and I know we want to try to get through the 40-40-20 section today. Representative Lively, I want to give you an opportunity as well, and then come
my,
back to...
My question really had to do similar to what hers is, though remember I'm colorblind, so I didn't know that was a brown line, but it's the same
black. Oh my goodness. It's black. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, okay, whatever color it is. Thank you.
Representative Lively,
ahead,
Representative
Mr.
Parrish, co-chairs, yes, very quickly, you're right. There are clearly students in that 18% who have benefited greatly from some college credits that they've acquired. They've gotten a job. They're doing great. And they're right where they ought to be. That tranche, that 18%, is also associated with some of the folks who are most at risk for default, who have accumulated significant debt, who don't have a certificate or degree to show for it. So there's a lot going on in that category, and you're absolutely right. One way that we've sort of attempted to address the question is by defining for the middle 40, and I use define loosely because there's not a formal definition, but when we attempt to approximate, as we have in the last slide, what level of attainment we're at, we use a broad definition, right? It's not just associate's degrees. It's not just community college certificates. It includes, under the law, registered apprenticeships. It includes career pathway certificates. It includes certificates earned by students attending a private career school in Oregon. So there are a variety of other ways in which we can establish this student has earned some level of post-secondary education or training that's resulted in a certificate that's transferable from job to job, potentially. But your point is well taken.
Can I just quick follow-up? The concern I hear from community colleges in my area is that they get kids started, right, and they get them some level of skill, and they may not have taken, the writing class or the math class that they need, but they, started in the skills-based. Welding's a great example. Get enough skills that suddenly they, they're getting swooped up by employers, and the employer doesn't care that they haven't finished. And so we sort of, on paper, kind of ding the community college because they didn't finish that kid's education or get them moving, but they moved into a job. So somewhere I just think we need to retool that a little bit so that, we acknowledge that whatever it was that got that student moving, even if they didn't finish, that community college is sort of credited for that, success of that, of the student, because they moved on and they're happy and, they're paying tuition. But that's not reflected in the community college numbers. It looks like that's a student who fell out of the system. They didn't complete, and we don't know enough about their story to really assign some credit for the fact that they got what they needed out of the community college system and were able to move on. So I think that, to me, is just a flaw in this model.
Okay. Representative co-chairs, so just the last couple of slides here on 40-40-20. I described already the effort that we've made through legislation we've introduced to help clarify 40-40-20's applicability to young Oregonians, but under this proposed law, permit the commission, likely in conjunction with the Workforce Investment Board, to create a more refined goal for our adult population. When we look just at young Oregonians, so if this legislation were to pass and we were to focus 40-40-20 specifically on young Oregonians with other ambitious goals for adult Oregonians, this is how we're doing. So these are students who were expected to graduate high school in 2006 and their higher ed outcomes as of 2013. You can see here the you know, fewer of them than have earned a bachelor's degree. That's 22%, 6% associate's degree certificate, the vast majority still at either some college, high school completion, or not yet having completed high school. So this is a different view. It's a more focused view on young Oregonians, not the entire adult population. It's the same view that's described by a diagram that you've likely seen before. This is, in fact, the same cohort of students who were expected to graduate high school in 2006, and their degree pathways or their educational pathways and their degree outcomes on the right-hand side. In addition to the outcomes, the relatively small percentages of them that have completed four-year and two-year degrees and certificates, you also notice here the sort of swirling effect of students who transfer from two-year school to four-year school or vice versa, as well as the high school diploma holders who earn GEDs, or the non-high school diploma holders who earn GEDs down in the lower portion of this slide. Senator Roebling, you asked about trends. This is just on the associate's degree, so this is a small part of 40-40-20, but this is Oregon relative to the nation. I'm sorry, this is not just associate's degrees. This is all degrees, associate's or higher. So this is associate's, bachelor's degrees. So it's the combined sort of part of the middle 40 and the upper 40 combined together. It's the trend since 2006. You see the rise in Oregon. To be clear, that rise is the result of a couple of things. One of them is the improving degree completion rates at our universities and colleges. The other is immigration of well-educated people to Oregon, and we are a net importer of people with degrees, and that's reflected in this slide, which, again, this is now focused on the entire adult population, not the young Oregonians coming out of our high schools specifically. But nevertheless, a fairly significant and notable rise in Oregon mm-hmm. that mirrors the rise across the country. A lot of, and you'll see this in future data, a lot of Americans, a lot of Oregonians went back to school in 2008, 2009, 2010. And we're seeing the benefit of that in terms of slides like this in degree and certificate completion in 2012, 13, 14, 15.
And as your footnote points out, that doesn't even include people with apprentice or other certificates. That is only associates and higher. So.
Right, correct. I want to go a couple more slides, and then if we're at an ending point, that would be a good yeah. stop. So the equity lens, along with our along with 40-40-20, really anchors the commission's strategic plan. And the equity lens was presented to you in connection with the Chief Education Office. Our commission has adopted it as well. It requires us as an organization to examine our policies, our goals, and our data with an equity lens and ensure that we are taking that into account as we bring forward budget and funding and policy recommendations or actions. We have a quote here from it. I use that just to introduce 40-40-20 one last time now, broken down by race, ethnicity. You see the significant divergence between our different populations on 40-40-20. These are all adults, but broken up by race, ethnicity. And clearly we have significant equity gaps when we look at higher educational attainment in the state of Oregon. And this is an area of real emphasis for the commission and is reflected in some of the budget and other proposals and presentations that you'll see over the next couple of weeks.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Cannon. And we will, unless there are any other questions from my colleagues, we will close today's hearing on Senate Bill 5524 and adjourn for the day. See you all tomorrow. Adjourn for the day. See you all tomorrow.